for the Bianchi identity, so it doesn't have any effect on the equations of motion.
On the classical equation motion.
On the classical equations of motion. So there are hundreds of other modifications where you can introduce other parameters, which identically classically vanish. And so you would have different predictions for these theories, right? So what is so special about this gamma there?
First of all, there are not hundreds of other polynomial expressions in E and omega.
But they don't have to be polynomial? Why do they have to be polynomial?
What is the question you're exactly asking? Are there other theories of quantum gravity that one could write down? Is that question you're actually asking?
No. Well, you are saying that you are predicting that this is the quantization of the volume. I am saying that by any other modification, you would get something different. So what is so special about this quantization of the volume?
Well, which other modification?
Okay, so you added the term, which classically is something like RABC cyclic equal to zero. So why don't I just term G mu nu nabla mu equal to zero term with some other parameter, but over beta? Because and then I would have volume quantized in beta parameter, or
G mu nu?
And the Bianchi identity, for example, nabla mu G mu nu, where G mu nu is the Einstein tensor. So I could add that with 1 over beta, and I would have different prediction, right? Or I can come with infinite number of these terms.
Well, let me put it this way. If there is another quantization where you have a Hilbert space, you have transition amplitudes that have the right classical limit, it would be very interesting to know. The game here, it's far less free than what one would hope. And I have no uniqueness theory whatsoever. The table is open to any alternative. Let me put it this way. In the 10 years, or 20 years, in fact, been around, no other credible alternative has come to the market. So if there is another one, very good. And let's separate the kinematics from the dynamics. Already at the kinematics, this is a Hilbert space with a set of operators that give three-dimensional geometry in the large quantum number limit. Okay. There's another one we are very happy to know, but it has to be constructed. It's not enough to say, well, at some point I could add other terms, and then probably if I would do the full construction. The full construction is complicated. It's not trivial. So,
but why do you know that this volume should be quantized precisely by the term which is just the Bianchi identity?
I don't know
why
anything.
Do you think that Bianchi identity is,
I don't know anything
is
about
broken
should
at quantum
be quantized
level?
I'm saying the question I introduced the course by saying, is there a quantum theory of gravity which is coherent, consistent, finite, and has classical generativity as its the standard generativity as classical limit? Is there one? The problem was posed by Einstein in 1919, and we're near to a century from it, and not a single one has been found yet where we have a full, coherent, consistent scheme. So the problem of uniqueness, in my opinion, after a one century of searching this theory, is of no interest whatsoever until one coherent theory has been found. Everybody in the, I understand your question because your question has been asked over and over again, okay? But everybody's focused on a uniqueness of this quantum theory of gravity in a situation in which there isn't anyone available, right? That's why I turn it back the question to you, okay? So that's the question which is around, you know, in the physical department. What about uniqueness, okay? But what is the interest in uniqueness in a situation which we haven't a single? Let's write one, okay? Let's make choices, arbitrary. We want one theory, which is coherent, which is a quantum theory, and which has the right classical limit. Let's find one, okay? And then if we have one, we'll search for other ones, presumably.
Okay, so but do you have physical intuition why quantization of the volume should correspond to,
to that particular action? Yeah, it's the only polynomial action that you can write in terms
the Anki identity.
It's the only polynomial action that you can write. In fact, depending exactly how you fix your requirements, you play the same game that you play in Young-Nielsen. Okay? You want what is the most general local polynomial with this Lorentz invariant thing that you can write in terms of these variables, and you have a very small. Alejandro Perez studied from this perspective. In fact, he was even hoping that since there are no other terms, you can sort of argue for the normalizability a priori because there are no other terms that we generate. It's not so simple. All uniqueness arguments in the history of physics are always a posteriori. Once something works, then after you argue that, well, in fact, if you list a sufficient number of arguments, you can, it is a unique, okay? Einstein didn't find the Einstein equations because of the unique equations such that, which is as he's written in the book, he found by just guessing, okay? He knew what he wanted, roughly, and he guessed. And when it wouldn't work, he would have loopies, would have the cosmologicals. It would work or not, somehow. And Maxwell didn't find the Maxwell equation. He was just trying to fit a coherent story in which Ampere law and Faraday law could fit together. Just found one. It's a unique one. It's one that works. In fact, it's not the unique one because there are weak interactions and it's just a piece of something large. But I think uniqueness is a very bad argument in physics. Right? So just find one theory that works, and then check with nature. And somehow, historically, remarkably, usually, the first relativist, coherent full relativistic theory of gravity that works, or the second, usually the one that works. Then one study all possible variations. There are possible alternative to the Einstein equations, right? Why should they work? I don't think the one could argue for simplicity, for we don't know. But I insist for quantum gravity. Let's talk about quantum gravity. The problem with quantum gravity is not how do we know what happens at Planck scale, everything could happen. This is the way often the problem is posed. If this was the real problem, we would have zillions of coherent quantum theory of gravity, and that would be okay. So they're all there. It's an experimental problem. It's an empirical problem. Let's make an experiment. But we don't have any. String theory works very well in 10 dimensions. Okay, but when you have to come down, you don't know all the problems that you know. Loop quantum gravity itself is the missing things before having a coherent theory. So why bother me about uniqueness once you can... The real question is there a theory of quantum space-time? Here is one.
Once we go to quantum theories, don't we even have a bigger problem with uniqueness? Because even if we have... We specify that the action has to be of this form. There's no systematic way of quantizing something for a given action. There can be many consistent quantizations. So even if you can fix the classical actions and know you want to quantize, there's still a myriad of different options
that
give different results.
That's right. Except that then most action and most options, as you say, don't lead anywhere. Because then you have to actually get to the actual theory. It's not sufficient to formally write down an action and formally write a path integral because this doesn't mean anything. So what people usually do is say, well, path integral makes sense as a perturbative expansion around Gaussian point, around the Gaussian integral. In gravity, it's well known that basically whatever you do, this perturbative expansion diverges. People have tried to turn it around in all possible ways. There are some that doesn't diverge are square theories, but then they're bad for another reason, because they're non-unitary. Even classically, they just explode away from Minkowski space. They're badly unstable, so they're not good theories. So I put supersymmetry in, okay, now it's more. But then it still diverges to two loops. So it's a long story of failures of trying to do this or this or that or that, the story of quantum gravity. So it is a 50 and more years of failures of various ideas. Now, history of science is full of sequences of failures, but usually at some point, and then something comes up. So it doesn't mean that it's going to be failure forever. It means that the problem is hard. But the problem, is, in my opinion, is to find a way of turning this theory with a very peculiar symmetry, which is general covariance, and quantum theory together so that they fit. So this is one way. And every change of that, it's interesting if it produces something. Not because it shows that this is not a robust construction. Fine if it's not a robust construction. There's another one, another similar construction next to it. Very good. Let's explore it and see. Okay?
But you know, the question is whether the quantization of the volume is not there before you can quantize it. So if I really write anything one over beta and at any terms which classically vanish, then that of course in the limit beta goes to infinity, I'm at the classical level. So I go to volume which is infinite, right? So which is the classical limit which I want. So whenever I find that the quantized volume is proportional to beta times or gamma times something, I haven't proved anything, right?
We don't want to prove anything. We're not proving anything.
So but you are saying that the main result is that you quantized volume.
Sorry?
But the main result is that you quantized volume.
Yes.
But there is a
coherent quantum theory of gravity. There's a coherent quantum description of geometry where the volume is quantized with a parameter. That's a statement. And that statement is robust. What do you find not convincing?
I don't really see why quantization of the volume should be related to the Bianchi identity.
To the Bianchi identity?
Yeah, because that's how you introduce this parameter. Why is there any physical intuition why exactly the breaking of the Bianchi identity should correspond to quantizing of the volume?
Why the breaking of the Bianchi identity?
Yeah, yeah. Because if you are writing this action, you're writing 1 over gamma and the term which is proportional to Bianchi identity, which of course classically vanish. So if I'm at the quantum level, you are saying it doesn't vanish, and the way how it doesn't vanish is proportional to this gamma. Okay, and now you say the volume is proportional to gamma, so the quantization of the volume is proportional to this gamma parameter. Okay, let's leave it later. I don't see what is the physical intuition behind putting just exactly this term. You are saying if I put another term, it will be the same thing. But then I can put anything and it will be the same thing, right?
No, I don't follow. I don't follow your logic. I think we're talking orthogonally. Yeah, please.
Yeah.
Please.
Yeah. So we are just putting the terms, so you have the standard Hilbert action, and then you are putting the term 1 over gamma. And what it stands here is basically the term which is like R, B, C, D, something like this term, which of course identically vanish. So now you end up with the formula that volume is proportional to gamma and then something here. So of course if I have gamma large, I kill this term. So if gamma goes to infinity, or if gamma is infinity, I don't have this term. And I have infinite volume, which is like the classical limit, so that is fine. So if I have large volume, then at the classical regime, I have the classical regime here as well. So that is fine. So why don't I put another term, 1 over beta, and then I could give you nu, lambda mu, and then, of course, classical limit will be beta goes to infinity.
Wait, David.
Yeah?
One thing. You're saying that volume is proportional to gamma and gamma goes to infinity is okay. But this is eigenvalue of this, say the smallest eigenvalue of a volume operator is proportional to gamma. Say the smallest one is proportional to gamma as well. So the way you're saying it, your smallest piece of chunk of spacetime would still be proportional to gamma, which goes to infinity.
This is not a classical limit, this is a super quantum limit. It's the other way around. So gamma determines the spacing of the volume eigenvalues. If you want to go to a classical limit, you want the volume is gamma j, where j is the spin. So the classical limit is j large, not large volume. I mean, if you have a harmonic oscillator, the energy eigenvalues is h bar omega n plus 1. So this is the size of the smallest eigenvalue. If you want the classical limit, you don't want h bar omega very large. You want n very large. So if you make h bar very, very large, you're going to a super quantum limit, not. So a classical limit is gamma small if you want, if you want to think in terms of your quanta being small compared to your volume.
Okay, maybe.
But again, the number of polygons, I think if you put the indices, if you try to contract indices, you get back to this one, if you want a covariant one. What the ingredients you have is E and omega, right? So if you drop the first Cartan equation, if they are not related, this is true. This is a bad way. This is always zero, right? What you really mean here is that is f of omega. So so this is non-vanishing, the first Cartan equation is out. So which means that you have the torsion in addition to the, you have a non-vanishing torsion in terms of, so that terms is a quadratic terms in terms of the torsion. Now, there aren't much things you can do with torsion and curvature. There's certainly not an infinite number of terms you can write. There's just that one and perhaps one or two more. Let's look at the paper of Peretz here. Study that problem, unless you go to non-polynomial things. But then if you go to non-polynomial things, then you cannot write your operators as simple functions of the generators of the of SU2. So then you cannot play this game at all. So in other words, if the question is, what if I do something else? Then most of the time, the answer is you clash against walls. Okay, so we have lost some, used some time. Let's go back where we were. So this is the lecture. Well, and now let's write the theorem. Now we're going to write the full theory. So I'm going. We had a full definition of the kinematics. Eugenio gave you a lot of details about the quantum space. And today, we're going to do dynamics. a full in four-dimensional one. And again, that's why I also wanted this to go in detail with respect to your question. We're not going to derive it. We're not going to do a quantization for the rules. We're going to guess it. Okay? But I'll give you some reasonable reasons for this guess. And then what supports the guess is we will prove, or at least I will state a theorem about the classical limit of the transition amplitudes. And the fact that this came out right is what supports this construction. So to do the guess, let me step back to the three-dimensional theory. We have, remember, in three dimensions, we wrote this formula. And I'm not going to write the transition amplitude. I'm going to write the partition function, which is somehow the object that, if you put boundaries, becomes the transition amplitudes. So I'm going to take a discretization of a manifold without boundary and write number over it, just to avoid writing every time the boundary variables. It's just a way of coding the transition amplitudes. So the formula we wrote is the integral in du, the simplest formula, one u attached to every edge of the two complex, and then the product on all the faces of delta function of uf. And that's it. Where uf, so we have a face, f, so you have u's attached to the edges, u1, UE1, UE2, or U1, U2, all the way to UEN or UN. And UF is just a product. Okay? UE1, UEN are added. And of course, since it's a delta, it doesn't depend where you start from. So this, we argued, defined a theory of quantum gravity in three dimensions. One way of writing the Pontano-Reggio formula, then from there we rewrote it with the spins. And it corresponds to the action E equals F, which is general relativity in three dimensions. This is a topological in the sense, it's a topological theory in the sense that the theory has no local degrees of freedom, there's only global degrees of freedom. It's all gauge, right? If you solve the equation of motion, it's flat inside. So there are no weights. It's just a rigid object which can only become larger on smaller, but it's flat space time. And local invariance is SU2, of course. And why this expression is interesting for us, because is a discretization of the functional integral over E and omega of this thing here, plus it defines a discrete version of E, which is discrete as a small scale, right? That's what you want. The length is quantized. Okay. So that's why we like it as a model to start from. And this is in 3D. But now we want in 4D. And in 4D, we can write an action which is very similar to that one if we write B wedge F, right? Because that's our action, where, however, B has that special form, which on the boundary becomes K equal gamma L, where K and L are the electric and magnetic component on the. So in a sense, we would like to we want to quantize not this theory, but a theory where B has some special property. Now, what if we just consider the theory without that property? What if we take seriously the BF action by itself in four dimensions? Functions, so this is as a function of a B field, an independent B field, and a connection. Well, that's BF theory. People have worked a lot. For any group G, in fact, You can write this for any group G. The connection is a connection in a group, and B is in the adjoint representation of the group G. And you know, formally, you can write the same expression again. So you can write this, where now U are group elements in G. So you can write Z. U, each one of an edge, each one living in group G, and the product on the faces of delta UF. And in fact, this was considered by Oguri. This and its quantum deformation were considered by Oguri about 15, 20 years ago, or an expression analogous to that, equivalent to that, as a quantization of BF theory. And in a sense, we want to modify this for generativity by breaking the topological invariant, by allowing degrees of freedom, by having B constrained in this manner, and by having SI2C, which is a non-compact group, as a local Gauge invariant. The boundary we see, SU2 is perfectly sufficient for describing the boundary geometry, because Lorentz group is broken to SO3, but we want the full SL2C. So we want a modification of that, which has these properties. And now I'm going to start to study how to do it. And the way to do it is to take that Z and start to rewrite it in a way that then allow this modification. So let me take that Z and follow what is going on and start to do play games with it. So let me take that face again. So we have our manifold is four-dimensional, it's triangulated, and there is some face. Face has edges around and vertices. Okay, the vertex go. The U's lives on, so U is here. U lives on edges. So let me rewrite that expression, a priori for any group G, by changing variables twice. Okay? Now careful, because this is going to introduce exactly the things we want. First thing, I want to introduce two new variables, by splitting every group element in two. So suppose this is the edge E, this is a vertex V, this is a vertex V prime, and UE, I'm going to write it as G VE G E V prime, where G VE goes from here to here, sort of, and G E V prime goes from here to here. And all over, I will always, when I write G V prime E as G V, sorry, G E V prime minus one. Okay? So I use G V E to say this element, and I use notation G E V to say the inverse of that that element there. So I can equally rewrite it as G V E G V prime E minus one. Okay? This is just a rewriting of the same thing. So I can rewrite this as the integral of all the dg v. Why? Well, because the Hare measure is invariant and the multiplication. So the du of that is like the d of this and d of this. So I've doubled my variables, but I define exactly the same quantity if I write this. Now I have the product on the face around each faces of the g's. So g v e g e v prime, g v prime e prime, g e prime v second, and so on until it goes. So I go all around this. This one, this one, this one, with all the g's. Okay. So I've just done the first change of variable. And now I do a second change of variable. Careful. Now I introduce another variable, which I call h. So the U goes from here to here. I introduce an H variable, which goes from here to here, which is just this times that. Okay? And H is labeled by a face and a vertex. So it will be F, V, V prime in that point here. And here, it will be an H, F, V. Okay? So if this was a G, E prime, whatever, V, this is a H, F vertex, where so H, F vertex is a product of G, E prime V, G, E, V. Sorry, G, V, E. Okay, E prime V, V E. Okay? And again, I can rewrite it as H E V is equal G E prime V G minus 1 E V. So this is the definition of this quantity here, the green variable. Let me rewrite the definition in a different manner. I multiply by this to the minus 1. So H E V, face vertex. So S V. H S V. So H S V. By minus 1, so G E V, G E prime V minus 1, equal identity. So now I want to add this H variables. How do I add them? Well, I just say that 1 is equal to the integral on the D F V delta of this thing here, H F V, G E V G E prime V minus 1. Where E and E prime are the two edges around the vertex V bounding the face F. So I can take that, this 1, of course, I just multiply a lot of group elements by the delta, just this 1. I put it inside, and I can rewrite this as the integral all this V. H, this is going to be the final variable, fv, okay? And then d, g, v, e. All this delta, so a product on all the fv of delta h, fv, g, g minus 1, e, v, e prime, v. And then this thing here. Product of the F. But now, since there is this H, I can group all these in a sequence of H's, right? This delta is just telling me that when I go around, I get 1. So I just take this H, and go around. So this is just the product of all the H, F, V, H, F, V prime, and so on around the face. And it's just still the same expression as before. So let me write it in a way which is much cleaner. So it's dh fv, that delta, so product around the face of delta of all this around each face. So let me just call hf. This is HF. So the product of all this that go around the face, okay, all the green stuff that go around the face, and then what remains? It remains this and that, And notice that this is all diagonal in the vertex. There's one vertex here, and the same vertex, and this for each vertex. So I can write this as a product on the vertex of a vertex amplitude, okay, which depend on that, on what? The G is integrated over on the faces around the vertex. Each vertex face, okay? And what is the phase amplitude? It's just this thing here. So the amplitude of a given vertex, it depends on all the H's which are around that vertex. So now you must have a different picture in mind. You have the vertex here, this vertex here, and it has a lot of faces around. Okay? Has how many faces that join all the vertices? So this face here, all the faces. So remember the picture, depending how many dimensions you are. Around the vertex, there is E, E prime, and so on, and there are the faces. This face here, E second, okay, and so on. And the vertex amplitude is what? Is one integral per each dg edge, okay, around that vertex. So since I have the vertex here, these are the edge around the vertex, and then the product on the faces of just delta of h of that face in gen GE prime minus 1, product of all the faces, this face here and a G here and a G here. So this is a phasor or vertex representation. This is a phasor representation of the amplitude, but this is a vertex representation of the amplitude. So we have the group elements, the green group elements, which are attached here. Okay? We're integrating on all of them. There's a delta function that glues all the elements around the face, and then there's an amplitude associated to the face, to the vertex, to this thing here, which depend on the various faces, group element associated to each one of its faces around, which is given by integrating group element on the edges. So there's a group element here, a group element here, a group element here, a group element here. A delta function of all the h's transformed with EGG minus 1 around, for each face, the two group elements on each side. Okay? And finally, well, before doing the final step, let me comment a moment about this representation here. This representation here is important. How is it related to the way, let's do in two dimensions, the product on the faces of dj, the product on the vertex of the 6j symbol? Okay, it's very similar, except that here we have spins. Here we are. What is the relation? Here, this is a vertex amplitude. In the spin representation. Well, this is a vertex amplitude. In a group representation. We commented, there's a parenthesis here. So how are the two related? Well, it's just one Fourier transform of the other one, right? It's, look at this picture. The way to look at that is to look at this picture. This is a vertex. Let's do it in three dimensions, it's easier. Now imagine that around the vertex, I put a little sphere, three-dimensional easy. So let's put the real sphere, S2. Okay? So let me Let me put a little sphere here. Then the sphere is cut by, is punctured by the edge, the edges that puncture it, and the one below, okay, back of the sphere, and is cut by each face. This face here cut this sphere like that, this like that, this like that, and the one in the back like that, this like that, and the one in the back like that. So the intersection between the two complex and the little sphere gives a graph, obviously. Okay? This graph, I give it a name, and is a graph surrounding the vertex, where the nodes of the graph are correspond to the edges, and the lines of the links of the graph correspond to the faces. Obvious. Okay? So it's a set of nodes and links where these correspond to the edges of the two complex and these correspond to the faces of the two complex. But if this, we have a graph, on the graph itself, we have the Hilbert space of the graph, with the Hilbert space of the graph, the standard SU2 of SU2 to the number of links, which is the number of faces in that case, divided SU2 to the number of nodes, which is the number of edges in that case. Okay? And that quantity here is a function here. It's one of the elements here. So the amplitude of the vertex is one particular element of this Hilbert space. But this is also one particular element of the Hilbert space, just seen in the basis, in the J basis. Okay? So it's just something in the J basis. And not surprising, they are just one transform of one another. Okay. How do we see this? How do you go from this, from one basis to the other one? Well, with a psi J of U L. Which is what? Which is the product on the links of the matrix element of UL in the JL representations times the product on the nodes of the intertwiner on the node contracted according to the way the graph is done. So suppose I do the Fourier transform of that. What it is? I have to integrate in du, okay, of psi j of u all the l, and then the amplitude of the vertex of u l. But the amplitude is just a bunch of delta functions, okay, which now h is u. Just a bunch of delta functions, okay, which put all this to unity, except that there is this group integrals. But what did group integrals do? They gauge transform the H on one side to the other, okay. But these are the invariant things. So they gauge transform on one side to the other, and this gauge transformation goes to the indices of the intertwiners, but that's exactly what the intertwiners are. They're invariant at that, so they don't do anything. So in other words, that's the delta function up to gauge transformation, is sort of the gauge invariant delta function. Delta function projected by integrating over the gauge transformation of the group. The delta function, the orbit of the identity in this ratio here. So what I get is just one here. So I get the contraction of all the intertwiners. One intertwiner here, one intertwiner here, one intertwiner here, contract, and this is exactly the 6J sim. So in other words, this is nothing else than the Fourier transform of that. Okay, just turn things over. Okay, so I close this parenthesis. You see what is that formula. And so far so good. I do the little last step of that formula, that way of writing there. So the amplitude of a vertex is a function of the H group element around it, one per each face, and it's the integral in 1g per each edge, the product on all the faces. Now, let me expand the delta function in characters of representations, as we did when the first time we went from that expression to this expression here. Remember the sort of the mode expansion? So it's a sum over spins. Let me put the sum of spins outside. One of the spin, sum of the spins, one per each face, of product of dj, and then the trace in the representation j of d in the representation j of h, whatever is inside, which I h g g minus 1. So let me just break it, dj g g minus 1. Okay, where this is one per each face, and this is one e and e prime, where e and e prime are the two. This is a face, this is E, and this is E prime, the two bounding things. Okay, so this is a amplitude for sort of a BF quantum theory for any group G. And now starts the guesswork. Now we want not that, but we want something for gravity. Okay. So we have to do two things. So now change this. Change this for gravity. So first of all, we don't want G, but we want SU2 on the boundary and SL2C on the bulk. More importantly, we don't want an arbitrary B, but we want a B such that K is gamma L. So let's see. What in which group should the H variable live? Well, the H variable sit here, around the boundary of this each vertex. When you put vertices together on the boundary of the thing. So these are going to define the Hilbert space on the boundary of my theory. But the Hilbert space on the boundary of my theory, we want SU2. The boundary, we have SU2. So let's just keep SU2, the H variables in SU2. So H variable, green variables, which are associated to a vertex and a face, we want them in SU2. That's fine. So this is going to be a function of SU2 variables, which is a geometry. Around it is something which is four-dimensional. There's something which is three-dimensional, which is a function of SU2 variables. It's fine. That's going to be the boundary geometry of each vertex, okay? But we want the thing to be invariant of SL2C. So let's just try to say that the G's, which depend on V and E, are in SL2C. So let's say that this is SL2C, meaning each one of these is SL2C. That's the first point where the G appears, right? This is the amplitude. That's all SU2. Fine. So I have all these SU2 things. I have a delta that glues the SU2 variables. And then the individual amplitude of one each vertex, which is dual to the four simplex, I want the SL2C invariant. And this is the thing that makes invariant whatever was inside, right? I want it invariant under SL2C transformation here, not SU2. All right. So this is a spin, SU2. This is just SU2. This is SU2. This is SU2. This is SL2C now. So this formula doesn't make any sense as I've written it, because this lives in an SU2 representation. This is living in some SL2C representation. Okay, what does it mean, the SU2 representation of an SL2C group doesn't mean anything? Okay, unless I have a way to connect SU2 representation to SL2C representation. So let's just try to guess, and guess it the following way. Let's put a y here and a y dagger here. with a parameter gamma. What is Y and Y dagger is the object that Eugenio defined for you at the end of the last lecture. So what is Y? Y is a map, Y gamma, is a map from a spin J representation of SU2 to a spin P K representation of SL2C, not any one, the one where K equals J and P equals gamma J plus 1. So from the representation J to the representation gamma J plus 1 comma J. Okay? Defined how? Defined by sending Jm, this is an element here, right? It's a standard, into the element pk, I'll just better write gamma j plus 1 comma j. This is a p and k. Jn. That is a map that Eugenio wrote yesterday, okay? It's a map that you can write, sort of naturally, if you have a parameter gamma, from an element of an SU2 representation to an element of SL2C representation. Clearly, if I stick this thing here, this makes sense, because now this map takes me from this, the Hilbert space where this matrix is defined, to the Hilbert space where this matrix is defined. Okay, so it has the right indices if you want. Then I have this matrix, then I come back with a dagger, and then I get back something which has SU2, which has indices in this Hilbert space here, I can trace. So that makes sense. Mathematically, it's something. Okay. Why is this of interest? Because on the image of this representation here, this is an SL2C representation, and here there are the generators of SL2C. And the generator of SL2C is the object which are gonna dual to the SL2C parameters, so it's gonna be my B. But on the image of this representation, that's what Eugenio showed yesterday, it happens to be true that the matrix element of the magnetic components of the generators are proportional to the matrix element of the electric component and proportional to the magnetic component. So generator of booster proportional to the generators of rotations with a parameter gamma, which is the gamma that determines P here. So these operators here satisfy this relation here. And that's exactly the relation I want B to satisfy for the theory I'm considering not being BF theory, but being generativity.
When you originally find HFB, just to find them as a product of two GEBs, and now when you cut this sphere out, did you do something different? So now you're saying that H is the green line along the outside, and the G's go through the vertex in the middle.
H is here, and the G's sit here.
But the G defines actually a holonomy from that point through the vertex to the boundary again?
This is a dual of a triangulation. This vertex is a fourth index. Okay? Each one of these edges is a tetrahedron. Okay? So there's a tetrahedron here, which is bounded by a triangle. Okay? And so you have here a tetrahedron, which corresponds to this, and here a tetrahedron, which correspond to this, and they are they are bounded by a common triangle. Okay? On the boundary, remember, you want a group element, which is the one that's going to give the area of that. But now these two tetrahedra are sitting in full four-dimensional space. So you want, by gauge invariant, to be able to arbitrarily make a Lorentz rotation for each one of them. So inside here, you're going to have a four-dimensional Lorentz frame that you want to be free to rotate arbitrarily. So this integral here is going to be the thing which implements local Lorentz invariants here and here. Now you can view it in two ways. As a G, you can interpret it as the Lorentz group element that takes you from the center of this edge to the face, this one, and this one to the center of this tetrahedron to the face. So you can think of the G's as the integral of the spin connection from the center of this to the face and from the center of this to the face. Okay? So you want that going from here to here and then to here to here is the same as H, which does the same object, except that the H, you're viewing it in the Lorentz frame in which they are together. You can always take a common Lorentz frame and just have a rotation between the two. Okay? You remember, morally, there's a delta function between the two. H is the same as G. So going from here to here, you can equally use a H or use two G elements. Okay? But then you want sort of to allow arbitrary Lorentz transformations in the G, which are going to project all down to the Lorentz invariant part of that. This is sort of the geometry which is here. But of course, this is guesswork, right? This mathematically is sort of the only thing I can do to put the SL2C inside there and to have something appear.
Question.
Okay. It's not derivation from first principle. Yes.
So I would like to. Why are the y's in this kind of order? Is because the d of g's, that's an SL2C. So
the trace.
So in principle, you want to have y dhf y dagger. Is that what you want?
The trace is similar, right? So you can bring the same around. So the easiest thing is to understand the order of the y is where we're doing this now. Is to move the D on the other side. So if you move D here, then it's much more visible. Okay. So here we are in this silver space here.
Okay.
So this takes me to the silver space here. Now I need a Y that takes me to the silver space here to this one.
Yeah.
Okay. Now I am in SL2C, so I am in this SL2C. So I'm here. Now before tracing, I have to go back.
Are we using tracing an SU2?
I want a trace in SU2. Yes, yes. The trace is an SU2. This is an SU2. The trace is in SU2. This is an SU2. And this, of course, is not now J. This is going to be a PK. So gamma J plus 1, comma J. And this is an SL2C representation.
So then you have an SU2 object,
which
is the trace. And you're still integrating over SL2C elements. So how do you? I mean, the trace leaves you something that's SU2.
This is an S. No. The trace gives a number.
Yeah.
Trace gives a complex number.
So it gives you a complex number.
Yeah, but a complex number that depends on this.
Okay.
So this is just a function of SL2C. Group elements is a complex function of SL2C group elements, which I can integrate on SL2C. So here we are. Let me just copy the two equations that I wrote. So one equation says that the partition function one equation says that the partition function is the integral over 1 h v f group elements in SU2, then the product on the faces of HF, which is just the product of these around each face, times the product on the vertices of the amplitude of the vertex, which is a function of the SU2 element around the vertex. And the second equation says that this amplitude depends on the H around the face, not just drop the V, because everything has a single V here, and is equal to the sum of 1J per each face. I can put, no, just leave it as it is. And then the integral on SL2C of one SL2C element GE, one per each edge around the vertex, of the product on the faces, the dimension of the JF representation, and then the trace in JF. And let me use a slightly simplified notation, because I just write it and you understand. HF Y dagger gamma G E G E prime minus 1 Y. Where, of course, this H really means the representation matrix in the JF representation of this group element, and this G really mean the representation element in the appropriate representation there, K equal J and P is gamma J plus 1 of these group elements here. And Y is defined by that equation there, just me copy, is J M going into gamma J plus 1 J J M. This is the full definition of quantum gravity. Okay? If you have if you want to compute transition amplitudes, you just do exactly the same thing, except that here you take a space with boundary. On the boundary, you have some of these faces. So this is going to be a function on the H, which are on the links of the boundary graph. And of course, this means that some of these will be boundary and will not, some of these will just sit up there and are not integrated. So you only integrate on the bulk ones, the boundary ones left open. Okay. Oops. Time flew. Good. So we have the full definition of the theory. This is it. The rest is argue that this has anything to do with general relativity. Or maybe I should say something. Otherwise, I'll leave you like that in the middle. So this is sort of a guesswork. The point is that, in fact, with a long calculation, one can prove exactly the analog of the Ponsano-Regge theorem. This amplitude here in the large J limit, so if you want, if you look at, if you Fourier transform and look at when the boundary has large J, is goes like the exponential of the action I, the Regge action, plus the exponential minus I, the Regge action. The Regge action of what? Of the force simplex that has on the boundary the geometry, which is determined by the quantum geometry that Eugenio was described to you the day before yesterday. So on the boundary of this, there's a graph. You take a force simplex with that geometry of the boundary, you have all the high, large spin, you take a large geometry, you put a coherent state there with a certain geometry, and there Regular theory gives you an action for that, or more precisely, a Hamilton function of that. It's a number that depends on the geometry of the boundary. And this vertex amplitude is the exponential of that, plus e to the minus exponential. We'll comment on the reasons of that. No pi over 4, just that. So in other words, when you put many of these, and you sum over everything, this is like summing over the metric. This is like summing of the connection. We'll see next time exactly how it matches. You're exactly doing the functional integral of all geometries. All these have an interpretation of a four-dimensional geometry. And the integrand is something which in the large J limit goes to the integral that you want, e to the exponential of the action. But in a way that in the small, it's discrete. So your geometry never becomes it's cut to the Planck scale. So this is what cut to ultraviolet divergences. Okay? But in a way which is Lorentz invariant. In a sense, you have everything. Okay? You get the cake and eat it too. Okay? So let's stop here, and tomorrow we'll start opening up this equation. Yes?
In three dimensions, it wasn't finite until we kind of Q-deformed it. What's the status on the finiteness of this partition function?
It's finite if you Q-deform it. Exactly the same. And the Q-deformation can be defined. So I just mentioned this. Sort of morally, it's already finite in the ultraviolet, but it's not finite for large J in the infrared. And if you Q-deform it, then it's a theorem that this is fine. It's a number. OK. Took a little bit longer. See you tomorrow.